Uploading. Tsunami Black Hole Megamix 2K3, now.
The fate of the whole world is in my hands.
You foolish man. I am Ajito Ryo Master. Allow me to reunite you with your ancestors.
Welcome once again to Thomas's Prerogative. I am not your host, Lucid Dream. However, your host, Thomas, is around here somewhere. Thomas, you there? I suppose I should open that up for him. Okay, there we go. Oh, yeah, the duct tape. I'd say this is going to hurt you a lot, or hurt me a lot more than it's going to hurt you, but I don't want to lie.
God damn it! Lucid, when I said I wanted to bring you on to, you know, sort of recreate that old hijacked fun, I didn't mean this part of hijacked.
How do you think I got all my guests?
With your sparkling personality?
No.
What the hell was I thinking? But yes, welcome back, folks, again to another episode of Tom's Prerogative right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your primetime host, Thomas Primetime Mattis. And joining me tonight, as you heard, which proves I'm outside my literal mind and figurative mind, is my good friend Lucid Dream. You know, I sat there going like, oh, you know, I want to do Collider Star, and you know what would be a good idea? Lucid Dream, and I contacted him, and I said, oh, sure, I want to come on, everything, and then I re-listened to episode 8 of Tokyo SOS, the same episode that people wrote back saying, don't have Lucid on again.
Yeah, this time they made me promise to keep my mouth shut more often.
Just listening to Aga, what the hell was I thinking? Does anybody want to place bets on how long it's going to take Lucid to derail this train?
That's funny. I thought I already did.
Not yet.
Do I? Don't make me put you back in the trunk.
Would I even fit in that trunk anymore?
I got you in last time, didn't I? I may have to shave off a little bit, but I'll get you back in there.
But anyways, as I said, I brought Lucid to talk about a show that both of us love very much. In fact, I was on his show back when it was still running to talk about this, and that is Kaleidostar, which is both favorites of ours.
Oh, definitely.
But, yeah. Or that didn't come out right. It's a favorite of both of ours is maybe a better
close
way.
Enough, yeah. You see, I don't even have to derail him. He does it for me.
So, yes, Kaleidostar is the first, actually, the first time I've actually done an anime, real anime since Hero Man in mid-January. Because I did the 2011 Thundercats series, and then for the past, like, 5 weeks, I've been doing nothing but Disney movies.
I'm sorry.
What are you sorry? It's Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, okay, so early in Renaissance era. Okay, that's fine then.
It was Sleeping Beauty, Princess and the Frog, Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. You know, good stuff.
Does Roger Rabbit count as Disney?
It is. Technically, it was the Miramax, I believe, and they are in Touchstone, and they were owned by Disney.
Yeah, we'll never see another film of that like again. Disney and Warner Brothers would never collaborate again.
Well, you know, I told Gerard, who I had on last episode, he helped me with the review. I think it will happen because, you know, all the players want to do it again. Steven Spielberg wants to do it again. Why am I blanking on his name? Robert Zemeckis wants to actually do it again. And now that his CG studio has been apparently stopped, maybe he'll have time to focus up. But like all the primary directors, it says that there are plans to try to do one, which I certainly hope so, because just think about this. Jessica Rabbit in 3D. It sells itself.
You know, okay, I'll give you that one. I can't argue that.
The entire
went off the roof here.
The entire theaters will be filled with nothing but men. They'll tell their wives, "I'm going to play. I'm going to a strip club, honey, with the guys."
Well, that wouldn't exactly be untrue, then, would it?
That depends on your point of view. Just don't sit me next to Pee Wee Herman.
Oh, Lord.
Maybe we should, though, get back on track to the show.
Oh, yes, please do. Don't let me stop you.
No, I just stopped myself. And you can make your own double entendre joke there.
I did nothing.
But as we said, no iTunes reviews, especially since iTunes is still not up. Thank you, iTunes, for taking your sweet times to get back to me. And, of course, no emails or comments. So let's get right into it with our cast and synopsis for Kaleidostar, which is an anime that came out in 2004 with the dub by ADV, which is now known as Section 23. Why is it now known as Section 23? Because sometimes to shake your pimp known as Funimation off your tail, you have to change your name.
You know, that sounds oddly appropriate.
Actually, before I get into it, what did you think of that whole story about Funimation suing Section 23?
I'll admit, I hadn't heard it. I've been pretty out of circulation since I stopped reviewing.
Yeah, basically Funimation was apparently one of the people, partners, that were sending money to the group that was partnered with ADV that like just left them and dropped them with the debt. And so they're one of ADV's debtors. And so they're suing Section 23 saying that they just like defaulted on their debt.
So basically, ADV essentially went, we're not ADV anymore. We shut our doors and we're starting a new firm.
Yeah.
Shifty eye, shifty eye.
Well, they're allowed to in Texas. I don't have a problem with it personally because it's not their fault they got off with the debt.
In the corporate world, we call this restructuring.
But but back to cast synopsis. Cynthia Martinez plays Sora Nagino. Sandra Carras plays Layla Hamilton. Jay Hickman plays Fool, or as we lovingly call him, the anime version of Herbert the Pervert.
Yeah, I've got things to discuss about him later.
Oh, please don't tell me you've changed your mind on him.
Oh, no. I have opinions. You learn. Okay.
Opinions you didn't get out back when, we were doing Kaleidostar on your podcast and talking about Jonathan in a Asuka plug suit driving an Evangelion.
What they don't know won't hurt me.
Oh, I'm sure we'll get into some of our favorite bits hijacked because. But back to cast. John Swayze, wonderful John Swayze, a.k.a. Holy crap! And people who watched the funny Lake Takahata Gamera film from ADV will understand why I said that, plays Ken Robbins. You know what? I'll give you the hard name here.
Oh, God. Where are they? Yuri Killian?
Yeah.
Oh. I don't know. I've never seen so many eyes.
Eleichius Gradola plays Yuri Killian, because in Russia,
in
Yuri
Russian,
Killian
in Russian, Killian plays you?
Yes.
I do know.
Nancy Novotny.
Are you
plays...
sure he's Russian?
I don't know about Yuri, but that's the name. It just sounds Russian to me.
I do know.
At least that's the way I pronounce it.
Right.
Moving on. Nancy Novotny plays Mia Gullion. Kira Vincent Davis plays Anna Hart. Kim Lee Nguyen plays Marion Bernigin. Tiffany Grant plays Jonathan and that other girl that's a bitch throughout the series. Serena Varghese plays Rosetta Passel. Lucy Christian plays in one of her best roles she ever did.
Oh, heck yeah.
Or as have ever done, because she's still going. Sarah DuPont, and the Dr. Kate. Rick Burford, let me try it again. Rick Burford plays Carlos Ito. And James Reed Faulkner plays Mr. Policeman Jerry. Which was very shocking to me to learn that a black man didn't play a black man. No, a pastely white Englishman who can't get a tan to save his life played a big, muscular black man. That's some range.
Which, you know what? Most of the time I see Mr. Policeman, I can really only think of Armstrong from Full Metal Alchemist. I just get the vibe off the character, you know?
You get a lot of vibes off Armstrong, but we're not talking about that tonight. So, synopsis. Being that this is a television series, it's a really easy synopsis, which, thank God. if you've heard my, like, when I have to do movies and how detailed I have to be.
No, this is a circus-like Cirque du Soleil thing. I'm going to be the best. Okay, there, I synopsized your show.
Well, there's Lucy's synopsis. Here's mine. Sora Nagino is a 14-year-old Japanese girl who dreams about being a star on the Kaleido stage. And as such, we follow her journey as she joins and becomes a star at aforementioned Kaleido stage with all her friends, Mia, Anna, and of course the great Layla Hamilton, as she tries to save Kaleido stage. Bit more informative.
Yeah.
But, you know, what are you going to say? But with that, let's get right into our review of Kaleido Star.
Only my heart. 本当に大事な言葉は
And we're back, and let's get right into our review. And as we usually do, we start off with music. So let's start off by talking about the different openings and closings. And we had four. We had Take It, Shake It, which is the first one.
God, that sounds wrong. On so many levels.
As I bring up my music file to look at Beast Tattoo Kiss was from the second season. Let me go to K. I at least know the opening names, but I'm pausing for dramatic impact, folks. Not
yeah, that's it. He's not looking for the answers. No.
And Yakusuku no Bashoi. Which is why I like the first one better, because it gives me an English name to say. But what did you think of the openings and closings?
I'll be honest, you know, they're adequate. They're not really anything special. It's not something that you're going to find yourself humming for the rest of your life by any means.
I don't know
but
about that.
But it does certainly, although don't get me, you know, I'll admit the opening for season two, Tattoo Kiss, yeah, you'll find yourself mumbling that one from time to time. But as far as the first season goes, it's all good, and it's adequate for the show itself. But I don't think it necessarily would stand so much on its own as a separate piece.
I think maybe in that sense I might agree with you, but I do find the songs enjoyable. Again, we do have that sense of to where with the opening themes, it's sort of a classic sort of style of the opening and closing themes. The opening themes sort of get you hyped up for the episode, and then the closing themes are sort of, I don't want to say, well, in this case, they're not so much reprieves or so much cooldowns, because they want you to still be excited for the next episode, but they are sort of more relaxing. They're more of a breather from the episode. But at the same point in time, I love Take It, Shake It. I just love the melody of it. And the same for the second one, who I'm not going to try to pronounce. but, you know, they're both just up-tempo, upbeat songs that I very much enjoy. They match the theme of the series very much, you know, especially the theme of Sora. You know, I think in the second one there's a point, and again, we're talking about sort of the opening animation here as well. You know, where they're all pointing, and it goes into that final verse there, and I love that sort of segue there.
Well, that's because essentially they were leading you into the show.
Yeah.
It's almost like they were welcoming you to the stage.
Which, again, and that's another way I think you can put the openings are, they're well, sort of like the opening song. And this is something we'll talk about again with our next point when we're talking about the overall score. But again, it's welcoming you to the show. It's the introduction to the show and to the show that the episode is going to be. And then sort of the closing is, so it's very credit-like music, but it's like very soft and that stuff. And you know, again, it's very much like what sort of credit music is, but at the same point in time, in this case, it's a little bit more upbeat because it still wants you to be excited for the next episode and to go to the next episode.
No arguments. No, like, smart.
I'm about to say what. I'm about to say what happened to the Lucid. We lost them. I guess he got slammed into a trunk and stormed away at 40 miles per hour.
Stranger things have happened.
I just want to know who'd be driving the car at that point. actually, another thing to talk about with openings that I love very much is sort of the introduction to the episode. You sort of get a preview, which you actually don't see that much in anime, a preview at the beginning of the episode itself.
It's a built-in teaser, just to ensure that you're going to sit through the episode.
Yeah, and it's just like, you know, hey everyone, Kaleidostar is about to start. You know, you know what? And again, it goes back to, it's like a show itself, to where, you know, at the beginning of the show, right before the first thing, you know, you'll have, welcome, everybody. Welcome to the start of the show. And, you know, da-da-da-da. Again, a lot of sort of the themes here is that everything sort of fits into sort of this performance attitude.
Which is a very good artistic choice when you consider that there are so many different ways to handle an opening. But if you're doing a show about literally producing a show, what better way?
Yeah. But since we sort of already started talking about it, let's talk about the overall score and its use in the series. I very much enjoy, you know, even though it's pretty much, I think, maybe like 13 tracks, maybe 15, 16 if you include the opening and closings. It's a matter of, I very much enjoy the score. You know, it's one of those rare times where, you know, this is obvious mood music, but it's wonderful in the sense that even though you know it's mood music, you don't feel manipulative by it.
Yeah, I have to agree. Even though, like you said, the score is limited, it goes to show the strength of the editing team.
Yeah.
By their ability to place that limited score scattered throughout enough that you don't necessarily notice right away that it's that limited a score.
Yeah.
I can't really think of any times where the score was used improperly during the series.
Yeah. And, you know, also, I think the point, and this is why I talk about, you know, it's mood music, because it's very much circus music to an extent. It's the type of music you'd hear at a circus show, especially a French circus, aka Circus du Soleil, for those who don't know. Because apparently, though, my mom probably wants to storm in and say, it's said like this, because apparently I've been saying it wrong all these years.
Well, Cirque du Soleil?
Yeah. But, yeah, but it's very much like the type of music you'd hear in a show. And it moves, you know, when you have a serious scene, you have some sort of that more serious sort of performance music. It's very dramatic, but at the same time, you know, again, it's the type of music you'd hear at a circus.
Agreed. It's not as much fun when I don't argue, is it?
No.
But no, you are absolutely right. They blend it in nicely enough. The music is essentially, it's part of the background.
Yeah.
It almost becomes the same as the background animation. It's important that it's there, but it doesn't register exactly why.
Yeah. It's the perfect balance. And it's something we'll talk about when we get to stories that, you know, this is one of those fine examples of an anime where the music and the background are used to a perfect extent to accentuate the story and the characters that are going on.
Again, I'm not arguing.
Well, I'm waiting for you to say I agree.
Well, I don't want everybody just here. I agree. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, that.
But no, I but again, then, you are absolutely right. They did, the editing team, the audio editing team did a phenomenal job. And I think that a lot of studios should really look at this series as how to do it.
Yeah. Absolutely. By the way, I'm just going to copy every time you say you're absolutely right and put it in a loop.
Yes, sir. Absolutely right, sir.
And every time I need my confidence, well, I'll just play that. But I agree. I think we're all in agreement with music. It's wonderful music. I would ask, would you actually pick up the CD?
What do you mean, would?
I'm sure you already have, haven't you?
I admit nothing.
Yes, by admitting nothing, you
admit everything.
You admit that you picked up the CD. You've not torrented the music or anything already. Just like I've already picked up the CD.
Little details, you know.
Yeah. But yeah. But with that, we're going to move on to our next talking point right after a promo from one of our sponsors. So when we come back, we're going to get into animation.
Yay, sponsors.
Hey, everyone. My name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman Homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman Homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986
and Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman Homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
And we're back, and let's get right into animation. And our first talking point, despite the typo to where I say, let's talk about the overall style of Who Framed Roger Rabbit,
I was going to make a joke about that.
Well, you can make your joke.
Nope, too late now. I blew it.
Let's talk about the overall style of Kaleido Star.
Well, okay. Let's be absolutely honest. The character designs as a whole, not all that special. Distinctive enough, but...
It's Gonzo.
What?
It's Gonzo.
Yeah. But the problem is... Also, it's Gonzo. Yes, being Gonzo.
That was my point.
Thing, but it's also when it's Gonzo, they all seem to share the same characteristics.
Well, but with that being said, it is nice to see a Gonzo series where they don't quit halfway through. Again, apparently, I'm absolutely correct in that.
Well, actually, you just kind of garbled on me, so I was waiting for it to clear up. But
oh.
All right. But, yeah, if we're looking at the overall animation, though, we'll get to the character specifically later.
Yeah.
You can see at certain points where they cut corners. But anytime they cut corners, it is never during key critical moments.
Yeah.
You can tell they spent a lot of their animation time and budget on the bigger, special, and spectacular moments.
Yeah.
But as a result of that, caused them to cut corners during some of the lesser scenes.
But one thing I would argue, though, is that those lesser scenes, there are a lot of times they're comedy bits, and so it's an easy point to put those cutting corners bit because it really doesn't take away from the scene.
Oh, no, I firmly agree. The fact of the matter is that it wasn't important to have it all that impressive at that point.
Yeah.
So they managed how to pool their resources and where to pool their resources very appropriately, so that when they needed that spectacular moment, they could afford to give us that spectacular moment.
I just love the sort of the overall sort of very, because it's very much of a blend between sort of that traditional colorful anime style and sort of the cartoony style. Because I think when we talk about, you know, them cutting corners, we're talking about when it does become a bit more cartoony, you have sort of a super deformed look at certain places and that type of thing. But again, like we said, it's during comedy, it's during, you know, where they make it very cartoony for a reason.
Yeah, which usually involves Anna. But yeah. The other thing, excuse me.
Monkey pose.
Exactly, thank you. Or, you know, more of a squid, or not a squid, what was it? Jellyfish thing.
Jellyfish.
But no, you know, more with the overall animation of it. The other thing I really liked, and this is about, you know, all the character designs as a whole, again. The fact that even though this is a circus setting, and, you know, there's a lot of spandex and tights running around, they did a fantastic job of avoiding sexualizing the characters.
Oh, absolutely. That is one of the strengths of this
'Cause I mean,
show.
if you tell people going into it, you know, this is a show about underage gymnasts, a pedophile's
Let's be
ears,
more.
ears are just going to perk up.
No, let's correct that. You would have to tell them this is an anime about underage
Okay, granted, but still, you
gymnasts.
know, the little pedophile sensor goes off. But the fact that they managed to do it in such a way that at no point, to me at least, were the characters ever sexualized in any way. I'm still not entirely sure how they pulled that off, but the fact of the matter is they managed it, and I will give infinite credit to the artists for pulling such a magnificent trick off.
Well, I know how they pulled it off, but again, we'll talk that, about that more when we get to story. But you know, I absolutely agree, and it's not just that, you know, they're gymnasts in gymnast clothing. It's also a fact of, you know, there are shower scenes, and we have the fool, and so it never feels sexualized. Again, we'll talk about that more
Yeah,
later.
we'll get to the fool specifically later.
But let's get right into the character designs, and let's actually start with Sora Nagino. And well, you know, I did say story, but we could also talk about it here because it does deal with her design as well. She has a very tomboyish design. You know, it's sort of that perfect quality of sort of masculine and feminine design is in her character.
I can see that. I have to think about that a little bit, but yeah, I can see that.
I mean, she has sort of long feminine hair, but you know, body type is more boyish.
I'm not sure if I'd necessarily go that far as to say her body type is boyish. Her body
Well,
type
I
is
thought.
unmatured, because if you've noticed, a lot of in real life, a lot of women who have dedicated their youth to gymnastics don't develop at the same rate.
Oh, well, I know that, but again, it is that element of like it's not easy, you know, she does to some extent sometimes look more like a boy, especially when she's wearing her overall outfit. And so that's what I mean by sort of that boyish sort of design in there to that makes her and I'm trying to think of the word, but ambiguous as a character.
Androgynous.
Yeah, androgynous, thank you. Look. Hey, a cornerstone of this podcast is my ruining of the English language.
Slaughter away, my friend.
But Oliver, what did you think about her design?
I really liked the character design. They obviously spent enough thought on it to keep her proportions correct for what they needed her as a character to do.
Yeah.
So by keeping her that smaller frame, the smaller stature, especially when you compare her against a lot of the other characters, she's one of the shorter cast.
Yeah.
But that's very important, especially when it comes to her specific character and how she reacts to everything.
Yeah.
But we'll get into that later. But I liked what they did with her. I think, you know, like the majority of the cast, they did a really good job.
I love I love sort of the overall color scheme, and this is for the entire thing as well. I love sort of the color scheme, the very circus-like colors that was part of the overall style, and I love the color scheme of Sora, you know, especially with sort of the dark pink. You know, it's not pink, it's dark pink. It's a little bit lighter on top, but still it's overall more reddish, darker pink in her hair.
Yeah. I'm not sure necessarily how much, you know, thought went into that, or if they just went, okay, here's a color we're not using yet.
Well, then you have Layla Hamilton, who is, wow.
So obviously blonde. You know, this is not, you know, a shade of black, folks. She is actually blonde.
Well, you know what, Layla... If you've ever seen Clad a Star, here's basic design of Layla. Imagine Paris Hilton if she was 100 times more beautiful, 1,000 times smarter and intelligent,
and capable.
A million times more elegant and didn't have a sex tape, and you basically have Layla Hamilton.
You see, I would have never even brought Hilton into the conversation on that one. It's not... Well, she is so far from Hilton that you have to make too many exceptions for it to be worth it.
Well, I'm saying, because there is the connection of Layla is the daughter of a hotel owner of a hotel conglomerate, and so is Paris Hilton.
Yeah, but I'm not sure I'd want to be that mean.
Oh, okay. See, I used it to proper up and bash Paris Hilton.
Yes, apparently just... I still think putting them in the same sentence is just mean to the character of Layla Hamilton.
But no, I love the elegance. You know, this reminds me of Relena Peacecraft. You know, one of the most beautiful women in anime ever, in my mind, but it's because of an elegance that she carries upon herself, and that's wonderful job of the animation of her, the way her character moves.
Well, and on top of that, again... She being one of the few mature characters on stage for this show, mind you.
Yeah.
And yet, again, at no point do you ever see her as a sexual object.
You know, even when you have the episode, which we'll talk in length about, probably one of our favorites, but where she stays with Sora in her room.
Yeah.
You know,
but I mean,
yeah.
they made her presence so well done that it's hard to turn away from her when she's on screen.
Yeah. But my point is, like, you have that scene to where she's in, obviously, what is sort of a see-through nightie, and yet it doesn't seem sexual. How do they do that?
Fantastic artistry and setup.
And tons of sparkle.
That... And, you know, I'm going to get a little ahead of us here, but I think a lot of that non-sexualization goes to the fact of how they use the fool. But we'll get into details on that one later. We'll get into specifics on that one a little later.
Yeah. Well, we're just propping you up and preparing you guys for our talk about the Fool, because let's face it, the Fool is probably our favorite character.
Yeah, I hate to break this to you, but the probably the fifth portion of this show is going to be Fool talk. Just warning
it's
you
It's going to be Fool and Jonathan talk.
Yeah.
That's what it's going to be. Be prepared to be
Fool and Seal,
by...
folks. Fool and Seal.
Be prepared to be invaded by a army of seals in plug suits and Evangelions.
Well, I'm hoping we don't go that far this time. I've been wrong before.
On so many times. But, you know, since we were talking about the Fool, let's talk about the Fool's design.
Now, the Fool, being the spirit of the stage, is allowed to be a little looser a character design.
Yeah.
You know, hence the longer arms, the longer legs.
Yeah. Well, I just love the sort of mystery in his design because he has that cape and everything. And again, considering, again, we'll talk about this later, but to the fact that he's kind of a clown and he sort of represents sort of the clown in the show, you know, just a very classical clown look to him. And when I say classical clown look, I'm not talking about sort of Barnum and Bailey clown. I'm talking more jester, you know, Renaissance Italy clown.
We're talking fool clown.
Yeah.
You know, when the king says, bring me my fool, this is the guy they call for.
Yeah. We're talking about a more Shakespearean, I think, would also be a better way of saying it.
Just without the jingly bell hat.
And a wonderful mask.
Yeah, the little diamond patch mask.
Yeah.
But considering, again, he does everything through tarot cards, of course his design would be very reminiscent of the images you'd see on a tarot card.
Yeah, and that's another thing. And I love those tarot cards, by the way.
Yeah, I would not mind a deck of those.
Yeah, I have a couple friends who are big tarot card fans, and I'm sure they would love that deck as well. And I kind of find it funny, though, that the last card he pulls up in this season, because really we're only doing the first season here, is the Fool.
Well, what's the old saying? A fool rushes in where angels dare not to tread.
Actually, I was going to say what my mom's saying is nothing's ever foolproof. Because fools are so ingenious.
Or as Douglas Adams put, what's the problem with making something foolproof? They overestimate the fool.
Yeah. Let's move on to, we'll do both of them, Mia Gulliam and Anna Hart.
Yeah, kind of hard to separate the two of them, since most of the time, if one's on screen, so's the other.
They're like Greg Ayers and Chris Patton in ADP.
The Ayers, Chris Patton and Abbott and Costello. Which I think Abbott and Costello would be a bit more appropriate, considering Anna's obsession with comedy.
Well, I think that would be especially more appropriate when, Anna is trying to get Ken to be her partner in the second season. But we're not talking about that.
No.
So Mia and Anna.
Their character designs are very much like the characters they're playing themselves. They are essentially the other end, they are the opposing ends of the spectrum, whereas Sora would be the middle. You know, Mia is the grace while Anna's the strength.
Yeah.
And they match their characters to that. Mia being smaller, more defined feature-wise, while Anna stands out, you know, like the proverbial 600-pound gorilla.
Well, you know, it's definitely a matter of that Mia, you know, again, you hit around the head, her character design, slimmer, more graceful, really more of the intelligence, where, you know, Anna, she's very boyish in her design, you know, very, or at least very tomboy. You know,
which is why all the female characters swoon when she does the serious thing.
Yeah, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a great balance between their two character designs.
Like I said, they're designed to show the ends of the spectrum that Sora falls in the middle of.
Yeah. With that, let's move on to probably the closest thing we had to a villain, Yuri Dick Killian, I like to call him.
See, now there's our Russian. Because Yuri is the Russian. But, no, his character background lists him as Russian.
Yeah.
But that's completely
bizarre. Which is why they went and got a Russian voice actor.
I don't know that for sure. I would have to fact check that. But I'm lazy.
Well, names sure sound Russian, but that's besides the point. But yeah, Yuri Killian, or as I like to call him, I'm Yuri Killian, and I use dick. Because when you want to smell like a douchebag, you use dick.
Yeah, the best way to describe Yuri's character design is, let's see, grab just about any boys' love novel you can. Look at the cover, and that's about him. Just with shorter hair.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, they made him eye candy. Pure and simple female eye candy.
Well, that's true. He's eye candy for the girls, but for us guys, I think George Takei can pretty much sum it up.
Oh, my.
But, I think George Takei has something to say about that. You are a douchebag. That's right, a douchebag. A total douchebag. And I went entirely way too easy into a George Takei impression.
But, you know, Yuri Killian's design, it's meant to show, again, that eye candy for the women, but specifically the eye design for the character lets you know right off the bat that this is the closest thing to a villain you've got, folks.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, that was very, very careful choice work, specifically on the eye design, that lets you know, okay, he's kind of the bad boy. Something's not right with him.
Well, you know, at the beginning of the series, he has a much more softer design. And again, this goes in sort of the whole mystery that we see in the series that they do a wonderful job of setting up. Because throughout the series, you're thinking, oh, it's going to be, again, we're getting more into story, but you think it's going to be Leia, but it's really Yuri. And they pull that twist on you like that, and it does really surprise you. And a lot of it has to do with, again, in design, beginning, he has a more softer, a much more, I guess, heroic sort of look to him. And then he gets darker as the series goes on.
Yeah, he kind of starts out with the, if you'll forgive me, the tuxedo mask syndrome.
And there's a problem with that?
No, but I'm just saying, because they start him out that way, that's why he had the softer look at the beginning. But as things went on and you started to realize more, they sharpened up the angles on the character.
Yeah. Absolutely.
He was about the only one that had an evolving character design.
Yeah. Let's talk about somebody who never had an evolving character design, Sarah DuPont.
Ah, yes.
Miss Kung Pao Chicken herself.
Yes. Every time she's on, I keep expecting to hear everybody was kung fu fighting.
But it was kung fu fighting.
That would probably make a hilarious AMV.
Well, you're certainly the one who can do it.
Oh, not anymore. I've been out of that game for way too long. I can't even remember how to fire up Premiere.
But yeah, no, Lover's an elegance to her. The design just screams out sort of the matron, mother, of sort of the other characters, I think is the best way to put it.
Well, again, and a lot of that was done by the fact that she was physically matured.
Yeah.
Compared to the others.
Absolutely.
And if you'll forgive my moment of perversion, she had breasts. Which...
There were breasts in this series, and I didn't notice them?
In a manner of speaking, I... Compare her to the other female characters in the series. She is really the only female character design that was to a certain degree endowed. We're not talking the impossible jiggle physics endowed.
So this is not DOA?
Yeah, but a realistic level of endowment.
Yeah. So in other words, what you're saying, if I go on to the options of the DVD and I put my age to 99...
No, but...
Because she's got breasts, and she knows how to use them. I'm sorry.
But never once does.
Oh, ZZ Top.
No, the nice thing with her character design is almost a polar opposite of her personality.
Absolutely.
Which is what makes her... character, you know, both design-wise and actual character-wise, as interesting to see on screen, because you know they're going to have her doing these strange, bizarre things that somebody who looks like that probably shouldn't be doing.
Yeah. And then when there are more serious scenes, there's an elegance about her that is just lovely to look at.
Well, since essentially she is the voice of the stage, she is the musical talent, they wanted the character to look the part.
Yeah.
But they wanted to be able to have a little more fun with her than just that.
Absolutely.
But we'll get into more than that when we get to specific characters and character.
Mm-hmm. Let's do Carlos then.
Yeah, now if there was somebody you would expect to have been the villain off the get-go, or expect to be, you know, worse from a character's perspective from the get-go, considering the first time you meet him, he's feeling up Sora's legs. It would be Carlos. And you know what? He looks like it, too.
Well, you know, just unique color scheme. I think it's the most interesting, because you have that red and black hair, and then he's always wearing that sort of light red, sort of pinkish shirt.
You know, looking at the character picture right now, you know what I can, you know what I think?
What?
Imagine what happens when Yugi from Yu-Gi-Oh! Grows up and gets a haircut and decides to be a man.
Oh.
Now, can you see that?
Unfortunately, yes. Really, we're talking about such a wonderful anime. You have to compare it to something like Yu-Gi-Oh!
Note why I said, grows up, gets a haircut, and becomes a man.
Still, it's Yu-Gi-Oh!
But the character design, he's got the spiky hair thing going.
And every anime needs a person with spiky hair.
Yeah, it just, you know, come on. It wouldn't be natural without. What are you thinking?
But again, it's that mature aspect of his design I think I like. You know, again, whereas Sarah is the matron mother, he's really sort of the overlooking father.
He's the
bad. Which makes... yeah.
Sarah's the good cop.
Which makes sense considering that they are, you know, as we learned in the series, they have a relationship. So it's good that they are a balance of each other.
Well, and since they are the two who essentially began the stage, it serves that they would act as the parents. You know, yeah. He, the strict disciplinarian father, and by God, they make the look match.
Yeah.
He just has that look of do not cross me. I will protect
you. Or I'll let you do whatever you want to do to my... Yeah, don't cross him, or I'll let you do whatever you want to do to me.
Yeah.
In the case of Yuri. But that's getting more into story. actually, I skipped him because he was right under talking about Sarah. But let's talk about Ken Robbins.
Ah, yes. The boy wonder.
Dick Grayson.
Pretty close. It's like, you know, this is what would happen if Dick Grayson's parents lived and he had the accident. It's like, okay, I can't get up there anymore, but I'll sit down here and manage.
Yeah.
And you know what? The look is about the same, too.
Well, with the exception of that his parents had nothing to do with the circus.
Granted, but that's completely beside the point.
Yeah.
The fact that is his look as a character, they very much make him look the boy here.
Yeah, I mean, very, and to an extent, a little bit feminine, not in sort of the same sort of...
They make him feminine in the sense that they made Sora masculine.
Yeah. I mean, I was about to say, you know, whereas, you know, Yuri was sort of, yeah, he was a bit feminine, but it was that sort of masculine feminine that is meant to make girls have certain dreams.
Yeah, Ken's femininity to the design is more along the lines of, you're going to trust me, right?
Wow. No, I don't. That when you say it like that.
Well, that's why he doesn't have to say it. He just looks it. And so right. You look at him, you're like, yeah, women are going to trust this guy. This is their best friend.
Their best friend and pushover.
Yeah. This is friend zone guy.
Yeah. Which, I know this goes for more plot, but again, one of my favorite funny scenes with him. Well, there's two. One is the episode that introduces Jonathan. And Sora's telling him about Jonathan. It's like, oh, you met a guy? And he has that picture thought of...
Yeah.
It's like, that's the guy you're into? And then there's the one where he's helping Sora train, and her friend's there. And she's exercising. He goes, so do any of the other performers have a boyfriend as cute as yours? What? Ken's not my boyfriend. He's supposed, you're supposed to get an energy drink right after you exercise. I'll go get it. I think you hurt his feelings. No way!
Like I said, he is friend zone man.
He, or as Chris Rock puts it, he is dick in a glass. Break in case of emergency.
Very apropos.
And did you ever think you'd be saying that about Chris Rock?
No, actually.
Let's move on to Mr. Policeman.
Oh, Lord.
A.K.A. Black Armstrong.
Yeah. Sorry, folks. That's really what it is. It's imagine, you know, Major Armstrong as a black man in a police costume. Bam. You've got it.
Though, maybe a better way to put it is, since this came out at least a year, or was in production 2 years before Full Metal Alchemist, that Armstrong is a white Mr. Policeman.
Yeah, but I'm betting more people have seen FMA than have seen Kaleidostar, so.
Well, unfortunately.
Yeah, it really needs to... I'm not saying FMA is bad by any means, people. Don't start typing. Put your keyboard down. I'm just saying, more people need to see this, too.
Yeah. But yeah, I love his design. It's fun to see... it's fun to see an actual black man in an anime. Something other than
that's
white
not a stereotype. I think that being the big key factor is that isn't a stereotype.
Yeah. Well, yeah. His design isn't trying to be played like a stereotype. It's more played as, you know, this is what an American African American is, rather than, oh, this is a black man.
Would you know?
Which
I find that funny. that a black American character gets a better treatment in an anime series than most white characters do.
Well, I mean, let's be honest though, Japan can be very stereotypical of black people.
Which is why I am absolutely gratified that they didn't this time.
Just watch Frankenstein Girl versus Vampire Girl.
Oh, Lord. Do I have
to? You haven't seen that, have you?
Do I have to?
Have you seen that?
No. For good reason. No.
Do you know about the characters in there?
I'm aware.
Oh, so you're aware of the Obama fan club.
There, like I said, there is a reason I have opted to not watch it. Thank you. Thank you.
That was the day I realized when I was going to hell, by the way.
Oh, okay, well.
Because I was watching that without... I was forced to watch it because I wanted to watch Black Dynamite, which they were going to watch afterwards, which you want to talk about a great black parody of black exploitation movies with Michael J. White. But before that, they watched that movie, and I saw that scene, and I realized I was going to hell because I was mortified by it and yet laughing my ass off at the same time. But let's move on to our final character designs, Rosetta, Marion, and Jonathan.
Okay. Rosetta, designed to be the child prodigy.
Yep.
And again, you know, designed very adequately for what they needed.
Small body, but again, there's a sense of maturity about her that's very unique.
And again, most of that is in the eye design.
Absolutely.
Which, again, you know, they made her eyes sharper in the beginning. And you saw they opened up a bit during her character arc.
Yeah.
Which, again, nice, subtle way to show the shift in character type.
Exactly.
Now, unfortunately, her character doesn't get quite the treatment in this one that she does in the second season.
Exactly, which...
But she does...
There are funny things to talk about that one.
Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, again, designed well, designed small, but given enough room to make changes for further on.
Yeah. And Marion, I think, is the same way. Again, you know, she starts out, she sort of has the same closed-eyed thing, and then, you know, with what happened with her story, you know, her eyes open up, and she's more cheerful as well. I mean, she is, her design, just, she's a kid design, and that's exactly what she's supposed to be.
Yeah, and they do, you know, they do a good job of making her design very adequate to that bright-eyed youth.
Yeah.
Or at least to allow it to turn into that bright-eyed youth. We'll get into details on that later.
Yeah.
Made her a great foil for Jonathan.
Which, speaking of Jonathan, yeah, there's really nothing more to say. He's a seal. That's his character design.
Yeah, an extremely intelligent baby seal that tripped Sora.
It tripped Sora and apparently can do kung fu and can work a soundboard.
Yeah, Jonathan's kind of the I'd almost call him the Deus Ex of the series.
But he is.
We don't want to have to explain why something is cute or funny. Put Jonathan in. Okay. Done.
He is the animal mascot. But he, you know what? There are animal mascots that just seem obvious that that's what they're supposed to do and they become annoying. Jonathan doesn't become annoying.
Yeah, they do tend to use Jonathan sparingly enough.
Yeah.
To keep him cute without becoming a problem.
Especially when, you know, they have most of the time on Marion's head.
Yeah, Jonathan acts as a hat for a good, 60% of his screen time?
Which is funny, because there's a scene to where he's on Marion's head, and then he's wearing a hat.
Lovely ironies there, isn't there?
Yeah.
But, I mean, really, if you're talking about Marion, you're going to end up talking about Jonathan.
Yeah.
The two of them are... one and the same at this point.
Yeah, and they especially become even more close during the second season. Let's move on to talk about special effects, since I think we've been talking about character designs for about a good half hour.
Well, there are a lot of characters to cover.
Yep. So special effects, what do you think about special effects? Because I know I love the special effects. It's one of the things they didn't waste any money on. They did wonderful.
Like we said in the beginning, when they decided that, you know, they needed that big special moment, by God, did they put the money into it. The little bit of CG they used was blended beautifully.
Yeah.
You know, at no point did the CG ever really stand out and go, look, hey, I remade the first Star Wars film. Oops. Did I say that?
Oh, poor George Lucas.
It was used very, very nicely, very sparingly, and only at what seemed like the right times.
Yeah. No, but I absolutely agree. You know, especially more importantly, they used it really importantly during the, you know, the performances themselves. And it definitely gave you that feel of a Cirque du Soleil.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Yeah, which the funny story behind that is, and I remember the first time I heard it from you, was the creator of this series actually never saw Cirque du Soleil before he created the series. And somebody brought it up and showed it to him, like, son of a bitch, it is.
Good for them. Well, that just shows that a good idea, it gets around.
Yeah. It gets around like Charlie Sheen on a Coke binge.
gets around like Charlie Sheen's dealer.
Close enough.
Yeah. Insert bad drug joke here.
Yeah.
Moving on. Straight up.
Well, since we're moving on, since you brought up the CG, let's talk about the backgrounds, because especially when they show the stage, you know, a lot of sort of the buildings and stuff, they're CG, but it's done to a perfect extent.
But no, the backgrounds, they're all beautifully, beautifully done. And you can tell a lot of times they reuse the background scenes, but you're not going to notice that on your first watch through.
Yeah, you only notice it after your 20th watch view.
Give or take.
Which shows you how good the story is.
You know, if I remember, I believe, I could be wrong, I believe this is set in Florida.
Actually, it's set in California. And,
are you sure?
You know what, when we reviewed this episode on Hijack years ago.
Yeah, we had big issues determining this one.
But you know what, I did hear something, and I think it's somewhere around the Los Angeles area. Because in the episode where they go to Vancouver to compete in that contest, you know, Freedom Lights gets hailed from Los Angeles.
Okay. Yeah, the only thing that led to a couple of questions on that one, well, mostly was a big problem in season two when they opened the show during sunrise and it showed the sun rising over the ocean.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like I said there, too, you know, they hail from Los Angeles. Also, the fact that they're within prop plane distance to an extent from Arizona. Because they trained at the Grand Canyon. I've always had the feeling that they're probably maybe a bit south from Los Angeles. Because they actually do give a name of the town. It's Cape Mary.
Okay, that was what I couldn't remember. I was looking through my history trying to figure out which town it was.
Yeah.
Was it Cape Mary or was it Cape May?
Cape Mary.
All right.
So Lucid is now looking it up.
I would never. Oh, what are you talking about?
But, so I can cover for Lucid, but yeah, I love the backgrounds here. I especially love the look of the Kaleida stage itself.
Sorry, muted to sneeze. Oh.
I just blame it on live podcasting. Say it's awesome.
But no, like you said, the design of the stage itself, very reminiscent of a circus-style stage.
Yeah.
You know, it has that very tent feel to it.
Absolutely. But yeah, it's also modern enough that it feels unique, and it does feel like you're walking into a unique performance hall.
Yeah, however, the inside of the stage does not match the outside. Not in the least. Sorry, folks.
It's a big circle. But I think that's it for animation. I think we love it. And I think the final thing we say both about animation and music is that, again, I said it before at the beginning, they both accentuate the most important part of the series, which is the story and the character building, which really, that should be how it should be, because I brutalized English language there. yeah, that should be how it is in pretty much any animation, because that is the most important part, is the story.
Oh, I agree. And the fact of the matter is, the backgrounds, the animation, and the music being done as well as it is wouldn't matter a lick if the story didn't matter.
Yeah.
All that stuff just does is helps us accent the story and accentuate it, making it that much better for us.
Yeah. Well, with that, we're going to move on to story right after a word from another sponsor.
Okay, let's get this show on the road, gang.
I'm Batman.
We'll be right back. Superman.
Monthly Mondays, available the third Monday of every month at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
And welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that promo as we continue to argue about where the hell Clyde the Stage is located.
yeah, because I'll be damned, they only mention it once in the series and I can't figure it out. Curse my vile memory.
But let's move on to the story, and let's talk about the overall themes of the series and how each episode plays out like a circus show. Because this is what I was alluding to earlier, is that the way the music is set up and the way the animation is set up, you know, really the theme is sort of the art of performances. And every episode not only is Sora learning an important thing about how to perform, but it's also every episode plays out like a circus show. You know, if you've ever, or should say a Cirque du Soleil type show, because if you've gone to a French circus or Cirque du Soleil, mind you, you know, and see how the performance is, you know, they have, they use a performance to tell a story, and then they have a little breather act, usually comedy or something or a song, you know, then another performance, and that's how each episode plays out.
Yeah, you've got the plain opening, which is just the lights on the stage, and the disembodied voice telling you welcome and prepare for this.
Yeah.
Just in case you're not intelligent enough to figure it out what's going on, we're going to tell you what's going on and then show you.
Yeah. Okay. And then we're going to play the opening theme. Then we're going to go into the story, and you know, that you have whatever the problem is that Sora's facing that episode, and you get a little comedy from the Fool. Then you get more of the story and a little comedy from the Fool, sometimes from Jonathan and sometimes also from Anna and Mia. And then more of the story. And it plays out like a circus. It sort of has its it tells its story and it has its breaks, very much like a circus performance.
Yeah, each show adheres to the same structure.
Yeah.
Which is and not of course a bad you thing. All.
No, well, I like it because I think it lends itself to, again, exactly what it's doing. It's drawing you into this whole idea of the performance art.
Okay, I think we can agree on that.
Yeah.
Moving forward.
Yeah, well, again, it's also, you know, again, you have the awesome theming of the titles. Everything is amazing.
I'll admit that got on my nerves a bit.
It did?
Yeah, it's like, not everything's amazing. Please, stop. I get what you're doing, but it stopped being funny after episode 12.
Well, but it is a common thing in anime where they'll have like a theming of the episodes.
Again, you know, this comes from being obstinately male, mind you. But
I'm just waiting for the anime that where their theming is to where if you put there's like two words every episode, and if you put the first letter of each word together, it can be it's a, like a synonym for a sexual act, like Deep Trouble, DT.
Oi. Moving on.
I was about to go Down Periscope, DP.
Good movie, by the way.
Yes, I wish they would have it on Netflix.
They do have it on Netflix.
They do?
As a disc.
Well, I meant streaming.
Oh, well, that I don't know. But
that's what I have. It's streaming. They don't have it on streaming, darn it. But at least I have Avastai, Casella, Me, Frankenstein.
But okay, enough derailing.
See, oh, wait. See that train down the hill? That's your fault.
Yeah, well. You get used to it after a while.
But let's talk about the plot of the major characters. Let's talk about Sora Nagino, Mr. Cheerful herself.
You know, I'll say this. I love Miss Martinez's work. But there were times she just got grating as Sora.
Okay. Well, this is a real change from last time we reviewed her.
Oh, no, no, no. I found her grating then, too. But...
Why don't I remember it like that? Maybe because you didn't get to talk that much.
Yeah, that too. But let's face it, you know, for this one, the voice is very whiny. It's very nasally. Unfortunately, it matches the character too well.
Well, I think that's the case, is that, again, this is who the character, you know, it's, especially when she's down, she's like that, but when she's cheerful, you know, very, again, very tomboyish aspect to the voice and everything, and so it just draws you into sort of this cheerfulness of this character, which I love very much. I love Sora's confidence and sort of, you know, again, that's why so many people want her to become a star and why people were excited and looked at her like, yeah, she's somebody people will come to see because she has this attitude, this feeling about her that people want to go see.
Well, because people like people that make them happy.
Yeah.
And she is Sora certainly one of those characters that is there to make you happy.
Yeah. She has that very distinctive ability to, like, you know, with her smile, to make other people smile. It's a rare ability.
When she triumphs, you cheer. When she fails, you worry for her. You don't pity her.
Well, when people are being a dick to her, you want to jump through the TV screen and beat the shit out of them.
I don't know. I don't think you could take Yuri.
Oh, I can take Yuri.
Oh, no. He's flexible.
Yeah. Not when I bust out his kneecaps with a baseball bat.
Ooh, did you
Mafia
really have to
style.
Go? That's not Mafia style. That's Kerrigan Hardy.
Oh. Well, I could be, what's her name that's on True TV and go all hubcap.
Hey, there you go. But, you know, back to Sora.
Yeah. But, you again, sort of the cheerfulness, it's also the fact that she represents sort of this character, you know, part of what makes her such a great performer is the fact that she makes mistakes. You know, she's not this perfect character. She has her flaws, and I think that's what really draws you into her character.
That's what makes a performance different. Because, again, this is something they ran across with the other characters and had to explain.
Yeah.
It's not enough to do it perfect. Perfect
yeah.
doesn't get attention. It's those yeah. little mistakes and her ability to recover from them.
Yeah. Well, it's also the thing of, like, you know, when you're watching Layla or you're watching Rosetta when she first appeared, yeah, you know she's perfect. You know they're champions. So you expect perfection. And, yeah, you're dazzled by it and you enjoy it, but, you know, so even though Layla's a great performer that does bring it out, it is also a matter of, like, you know what you're getting. Because Sora's not perfect, it is a matter of, like, oh my god, what's going to happen now? And you are, even though it might be a performance she's done 1,000 times, she might slip on this performance and do something magical.
Yeah, every performance is different.
Yeah.
Which I think that was explained very, very well during the Little Mermaid sequence.
Exactly.
You know, where they showed it's not enough to do it perfect.
In that episode, she was trying to be Layla, and people didn't want to see Layla. It just made them want to see Layla. She had to make the Little Mermaid her own. And which, by the way, in that episode, thank you, writers, for proving why Little Mermaid works better as a happy ending story.
Oh, spoiler, I think the writing, fun.
I think the writing's on the wall now.
I think we should have made it a tragic comedy. But that way Anna would have got more screen time. But moving on. But yeah, Sora, again, Sora didn't really have a character arc to speak of. She was, at the end, pretty much the same as she was at the beginning.
Well,
she was better,
pretty much the series.
Maybe a little more motivated, but as for character development, not a whole lot.
Well, she didn't change as a character, but that's because she was already, to an extent, very far along as a character. You know, she already had this very cheerful attitude, but it was about her learning the techniques of the industry and learning the importance of everything so that she could be as good of a performer as she could be. Where she grew was as a performer, not as a person.
Now, the only time I will say that she showed, you know, an actual level of growth as a character, a discernible level of growth, I should say, was during the circus sequence. When she was specifically being taught that being the center of attention isn't the best place to be.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's more important to rise up the others than yourself.
Yeah. Though I would also say she had some good character building moments when, you know, the whole episode where her baby sister was born.
But again, that didn't necessarily change her character in any way that affected the show.
Yeah.
It was nice to humanize her that way. But as for growth of her character within the confines of the show itself, there wasn't a great deal. It was all just getting her to that performance level.
Absolutely.
Her character growth was not her own. It was her effect on the characters around her.
Yeah.
Because as something I like to explain to people is this show is not necessarily about Sora. Yes, she is the main character. She is what the show revolves around. But the show is about Sora's effect on everyone around her, not on her herself.
Yeah. And God, I'm having so much editing me getting up and off a chair. My ass hurts.
See, that's why I have a big cushy armchair.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a simple folding chair that just has a simple pad in it. But, I absolutely agree with you. As I go right back into it, that's something that's going to be on the cutting room floor there, folks, what we were just talking about. But yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And you're just drawn so much into her character, and I think that's, again, great voice acting, great movement of the animation of the character, and that, overall, it's just, you know, fun storytelling. You know, again, simple story, but they use a lot of character building aspects, whether it be more internal or external. It always varies, but, you know, there is a building of the character, a learning curve, and you learn along with her. With that, let's move on to Layla Hamilton.
Now we want to talk character arcs. Yes. Now, Layla, she had a huge arc as a character. Let's be absolutely, she started off the series literally as what you would expect, the stage prima donna.
Yeah.
This is my stage, how dare you sully it with your amateurishness.
Yeah. And it wasn't, you know, because, oh, well, I hate all amateurs. It's like, you know, there's a certain aspect, you know, it's almost the aspect of, like, this person just came on, she's an amateur, and all of a sudden Carlos is putting her in the show. You know, she has no training, she doesn't have what it takes. You know, at this point in time, she shouldn't be here.
Yeah, she's making constant mistakes in a show I have worked to make perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And she literally gives you that vibe of you don't belong on stage with me.
Mm-hmm. But as the series goes along, she learns that, you know, Sora is the partner that brings out the best in her because it keeps her on her toes.
Well, yeah, and that's pretty much is by the end of it, she's questioning, do I deserve to be on stage with Sora?
Yeah. And that's such a great, build of character throughout the series. You really see it, especially when she becomes the masked star, which, God, there have been harder mysteries on Case Closed.
Yeah, I've seen more mysteries than Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, like, that's better.
I wonder who that could be. Zoink, Scoob?
It's Layla! What a shock! Wait, or, excuse me, what a twist!
What a twist! But not to mention, there's not just her growth as the performer, though, but the fact that she finally learns to have expectations and wants of her own.
Yeah.
Beyond those of her father.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the thing also is, you know, she's really crossed throughout most of the series because she loves the Kaleidoscapes and she loves to perform, but she also loves her father. And, you know, she's caught between wanting to do what she loves and wanting to please her father.
Which, you know, we were all very grateful that in the end, she got both.
Yeah. Even though her father probably doesn't deserve it, being that he's such a dick.
But you understood his motivations.
Yeah.
You know, he was being a father. He wanted, you know, he wanted his daughter to have the better life, and he was trying to lead her in the direction he believed she could get it.
Yeah.
But he was so busy and self-absorbed with himself that he failed to see what she truly was.
Absolutely. And by the way, I do love sort of the similarity of why they love Kaleidoscapes stages done between Layla and Sora, because you have that in that one episode where they're training for the Arabian Nights, to where, you know, they talk about, you know, the performance that made them want to join Kaleidoscapes Star, and it being basically the same performance.
Well, it was the same performance. It was the same performance of Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
Because when they show them both flashing back to it, it's the same group on stage.
Yeah. And so it could be hinted that they were probably in the same audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, by the way, that is something I think would make a great OVA for Kaleidoscapes Star, is to basically do these, like, 30-minute shorts where they actually show the performances in whole.
That would have been nice, but I can understand why they didn't.
Well, I'm saying, like, they could do it now. It's like it could be an extension of the series they could do now.
True, true. I mean, considering we've got, what, 3 OVAs out right now?
Yeah, you have Layla's bike ride.
Huh?
One of the OVAs is Layla basically riding a bicycle through New York State trying to find herself.
Well, I haven't actually watched the OVAs, so.
Yeah. The one that's on New Wings is about Rosetta.
And I believe they had, or no, they never did package Legend of the Phoenix.
Well, Legend of the Phoenix is the one where Layla rides her bike.
Oh, okay.
And then the third one is, it's basically 3 shorts. One is May, Chinese cooking. The other is Rosetta teaching Diablo. And then the other one is Marion and Jonathan doing something cute.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
But absolutely, yeah. It's a matter of, I love sort of how it connects them, and it just starts this bond that goes through the rest of the series between Layla and Sora.
Well, and, you know, again, like I said, the show being about Sora's effect on everybody else, we got to see every bit of the evolution of Layla's character. Yeah, specifically, you know, and that all started at the birthday scene.
Yeah.
And she's trying to act all indignant of how dare you throw me this party. But you get to hear the inner monologue where it almost makes her feel like she doesn't deserve it.
Yeah.
It's not that she didn't want it. She feels she doesn't deserve it.
I absolutely agree. But another thing I absolutely like is I love sort of the very... There's Okay.
What?
Blowing in the wind.
What?
Did you just blow into your mic?
No, but my hand got close, so it's possible. Sorry. My bad.
Live podcasting is awesome.
I'd be glad we're not doing this over live stream.
There's a very underlying, undertonal idea of romance between them two. It's not like, you know, oh, they're so in love with each other and they're going to get married, but they're, you know, there's this connection between the two of them that where I could totally see it that if Sora was a guy, that they would be getting together by the end of the series.
Well, and that ties into the partner theme.
Yeah.
But again, the fact that they managed to get away from any level of sexualizing of the characters.
Yeah.
Made the necessity of male-female pairing not have to happen.
Absolutely.
Until season two blows that one.
Yeah.
But that's a story for another time.
Yes. Well, next we have the Fool, but do you want to save the Fool for later?
I don't know.
Because, well, you know what? Let's talk about the Fool, because we are going to talk about the comedy of the Fool.
Yeah, what I was about to say, we might as well just get the Fool over with now.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Fool, our favorite our favorite character, and as we called him before, Herbert the Pervert of the East.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, the Fool, his essential purpose in the show is he is the key to the ultimate trick.
And he's searching for people who can perform it.
Yeah.
And first he finds Sora, and then when Layla finally reaches a certain point, Layla becomes the other person.
Yeah. Now, his big trick is the tarot card reading, which is basically his way of telling you bad shit's about to happen. As Sora even points out to him, it's, couldn't you give me a good prediction for once?
Well, but then the whole point is that even though I have a bad, he says it, even though the prediction may turn out bad, it's up to the person to decide their own fate. It's not the thing to where, oh, her fate's set in stone, and it shows Sora's power and her ability to turn a mistake into something amazing, and the fact that she always turns his negative fates into good fates, because at the end of each episode, he'll put another tarot card, and it's a good tarot reading.
Well, the example of that would be, if I remember correctly, the hangman they used during the Arabian Nights bit.
Yeah.
And how in the first production, she fell at the end.
Yeah.
And Layla caught her. And that became a staple of the show.
Mm-hmm.
But the Fool's secondary purpose. The Fool, ladies and gentlemen, is the stereotypical pervert. Now, because he's doll size, we're talking to the point where he will hide in a soap bottle with the hopes of seeing Layla getting in the shower. Yes, this does actually happen. The constant perverted comments, the twisted little entendres.
Well, let's be honest, it's not perverted comments. Like, you know, at the end of the day, it's things like, well, ooh, she, Layla's here, or things like, it's not anything sexualized, but yet still, they're little, it's things like, when Layla comes to visit, Sora stuffs him in, and we do mean stuffs him in a drawer to the point to where you can see his little hand flailing up and down.
While Sora's telling Layla, you know, don't trounce around here in your underwear.
Yeah. And then later at night, he's like, how did you get out? She's like, I was extremely motivated.
Yeah. Now, to me, I'd like to think that the entendres and the perverted nature of the Fool, along with Sora's reactions to the Fool, helped keep this from being sexualized.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I think that's what it did, because it is, this is played so much for comedy and sort like a comedy team that, yeah, it definitely, I would agree with you. It definitely helps towards the desexualization of the series itself. It's almost as if, you know, we're acknowledging the some bits of sexuality that are here and really desensitizing them.
Yeah. We're acknowledging that this could be taken in a wholly perverted manner, but we're going to put it in such an outlandish context that you won't be able to see it that way later.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, the thing that really sets it all up is, we called it the many deaths of Fool.
Yeah.
Better be being eaten by Jonathan. There's a favorite one where Sora's with her friend, and, you know, she's tying him up with rope, and he's going, "What are you doing?" "Oh, I'm doing hand exercises." Like, "I haven't done anything yet." I know what your personal favorite is.
By all
means. Oh, no, that was Random's.
By all means, go for it.
No, I'm sorry. That was Random's. Random said, when we were doing it, we had our friend Random on, and he said, is the one where they're in the apartment. And you see Mia do a handstand, and they never show a panty shot. You see her legs go up and her dress start to fall down, but they never, by the way, show the panty drop again. You know, not sexualizing the scene, because it then immediately cuts to
the fool kind of jaw drop state, shall we say?
Not jaw drop, but he's like laying down with his arms propping up his face, and you know, Sora makes mention of dreams coming true, and he goes, "Just like mine."
Yeah. Okay.
You remember that?
Yep.
And then he gets hit by a pillow with Sora.
But, you know, for a lot of it, a lot of the time during the series, the Fool can be taken as a throwaway. He's more of an the hell's the term?
He's a clown.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's just a simple way to put it. Well, he's the clown.
Exposition tool. That's the term I'm looking for. He is an exposition tool.
Well, yeah, he's both. He's a clown and he's an exposition tool. You know, he's, to an extent, he's the narrator.
And, you know, you really don't understand his purpose until about the final third.
Yeah.
When you realize that he is the keeper of the stage's secrets.
Mm-hmm. And it is a thing to where, you know, and they do really hint throughout the series that he has more to him. But again, for the most part, he's guiding Sora to, you know, what he's trying to help her understand.
And they tend to hide his greater purpose under the perversion.
Yeah. But going back to the perversion, because I love talking about the comedy so much. The other favorite scene is when Sara comes to their apartment and they're talking to her. And all of a sudden you see Sora become the Flash. He's like, and nobody knows she was gone. It's like, "Oh, well, relax." And then you see that the Fool has been, she put his hair underneath the TV. There's that. There's when she put him in a hot dog bun and went to cook him.
The Fool gets tormented quite a bit at the hands of Sora, but he deserves it.
There's when he keeps getting hit by the Diablo.
Okay, that one maybe he didn't deserve.
But where are you? I'm on the cop!
But yeah, the Fool is a character, even though for the longest period of time he does seem like a throwaway.
Yeah.
He does finally show his importance and purpose, but yeah, all at that point when Layla begins to see him. It's then, you know, they drop the pretext of perversion, and you really don't see much of him after that point.
Yeah. And, you know, and he's pretty much the same in the second season as well. And I say that because one of my favorite parts in the second season is when he has the little dragon puppet on.
Yeah.
Or a lion. It goes, "Time to wake up, sleepyhead."
Yeah, when he traded in the tarot cards for the crystal ball.
Yeah. Come, my pretty, come. Let's move on to Kent and Robin.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to Mr. Friendzone.
Friendzone, who wants to be more than a friendzone. Which, by the way, how old is he?
Let's see. In this one, he's listed as 18, but I'm not sure I necessarily buy that because they also have Sora listed as 16. So I'd be willing to bet he's probably 16.
I thought she was 14, so yeah, I'd say I hope he's 16.
Yeah.
If he's 18.
And she's 14, that makes things a little squicky.
Yeah. I'm just going to go with it. You know what? He looks 16.
We'll assume he's 16.
Yeah. Well, he does look like he's 16, mind you.
Yeah, and bear in mind, the character profile I'm looking at right now is not an official one.
Yeah.
Yeah, truth be told, folks.
Yeah. Well, I believe in the anime they say that Sora's 14, so... But, it is a matter of, he's the guy that has a crush on her. Besides the policeman, but the policeman's crush on her is more
fatherly. It's platonic, mind you.
Yeah. But he's also sort of the emotional support for Sora.
He is the emotional support and the voice of reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is the one who knows when to push her, but knows when to coddle her, too.
Yeah.
Knows when to tell her you're being stupid, stop it. But also knows when to tell her, get your ass back on the bars now. Which, you know, they showed that one during the big training sequence for the finale.
Yeah. Well, really, for the most of the series, he's more of a coddler. It wasn't until, basically, Carlos told him, look, you can't coddle her here. You need to be tough on her.
Well, if you remember, during the Little Mermaid sequence, was, again, he was the one who got her back on the bars.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't necessarily through coddling, it was through subtle manipulation.
No, that and Sarah basically
making a fool out of her for a 20-minute yeah. episode.
taking her to Mr. Kung Pao
yeah.
there. Like, whee! Oh, yeah! I'm like, oh, God, help me.
But, you know, Ken is the character. He is... He's that friend everybody wants.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, because of that, he's also not necessarily seen as a male entity to these female characters.
Or as Chris Rock puts it, dick in a glass, breaking case of emergency.
You see, I'm not even sure they'd realize that he has the apparatus.
Oh.
Be absolutely honest, Ken Robbins is pretty close to being a Ken doll.
Oh.
For all the consideration the female characters give him in the relationship sense.
You know what? I have a better way to describe it. His real name, he should be Ken Robbins. He should be Ken Rogers.
Yeah.
Because he takes him, it makes a great joke. I'm like, oh, so Ken's taking him to Mr. Rogers' neighborhood.
But yeah, you know... He is your stereotype. He is your good guy.
Yeah. I mean, and let's be honest. Just saying that you can imagine, you know, turning on Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, seeing Dragon going ding, ding, going to the tunnel, and there's Ken.
Yeah.
And that's a good way to put it. Let's move on to Yuri Killian.
Okay. Now, I know a lot of people just look at Yuri as, you know, right bastard evil man.
And boy toy to the girls.
Yeah, but, you know, I can't. Because I understand they do a very good job near the end of helping to explain why he does what he does, which turns him into a sympathetic villain of sorts. He doesn't seem like the villain anymore by the end.
Well, you know, they're very subtle with telling his story. And one of the things that, it makes you feel bad about, you know, really your hate for him actually comes towards the end of the series when he's doing, being a jerkwad and doing all these dick maneuvers to so-called Freedom Lights. But, you know, at the beginning when they his twist, you know, he reveals, you know, his whole hatred is he feels Carlos killed his father.
Yeah, he never accepted that it was his father's mistake that he died.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is,
it wasn't even his father's or Carlos's, for that matter, as we'll talk about in a second. It was really his partner, which never gets named in the series.
Well, no, because it was Carlos that planted the seed of doubt.
Well, you know, but
But that was more for Carlos's personal story arc than it was for Yuri's.
Well, we'll talk about that then.
Yeah, we'll talk about that one later.
But with Yuri, yeah. But at the same point in time, in the beginning of the series, he was really, you know, he was also a sympathizer that helped Sora motivate. You know, he was the one who gave her the clue of how to do the Burning Phoenix maneuver.
But, you know, as you get to the halfway point of the series and he turns out to be the quote-unquote villain.
Yeah.
It seems like he's doing such horrible, horrible things, and you can't tell why. You just start thinking, hey, this man's a right bastard. And then at the end, you realize he did this all because he's trying to protect everyone.
Yeah.
Well, I may not agree with why and how he did it, but I can't necessarily argue the fact that he was trying in his own way to do good.
Can't argue it, but, you know, one thing I can is that he has obviously no common sense, because anybody who thinks that people would rather come and see a, like, light show rather than actual performances obviously didn't think it through.
Well, no, he was blinded by the issues with his father, that the only thing he could see was, I need to keep everyone safe.
I don't know if I'll agree with that much, but, you know, I can see where you're coming from. Let's move on to Carlos.
Ah, the great manipulator.
the initial Mr. Jerkwad of the series. Because there are times where you just want to go up and slap the taste out of his mouth and say, you go to that girl right now and you explain things to her.
But,
and don't get me wrong, I understand why he does it, but it's still frustrating.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't matter if you're doing it for good reasons. A dick move is still a dick move.
Yeah. It's like, really? You can't just give him a clue? We can't buy a clue. We can't buy a vowel or anything here.
Nope, you need a dancing bunny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, like I said, we do to an extent understand why he's doing it, which is, you know, if he told her everything to do, she wouldn't be dependent upon herself to learn.
Well, and that was the big thing, is every horrible, mean, wicked, evil thing he does, specifically to Sora, was just to get her to realize what she needed to know to become that star.
Yeah. You know, whether it be like lessons, and that's the thing, is every episode is a different lesson that Sora learns, at least up to a certain point, up to towards the finale, where it's more about, you know, the cast trying to get Kaleidostage back. But for the most part of the series, it's Sora learning because of the things that Carlos puts her through.
And let's be absolutely honest, he is the ultimate manipulator of people.
Mm-hmm. But at the same point in time, it is that matter of, you know, we were just talking about a couple minutes ago. You know, he also lets Yuri get away with this stuff because he feels responsible for his dad's death. And, you know, he says it. What he says was, you know, I put that seed of doubt in there. So he personally felt like maybe he's the one who caused the death. But as it gets revealed by the Fool a little bit before that, is that, you know, one of the performers lied to him. The partner of Yuri's dad lied about being able to see the Fool and could not see it. So no matter what type of you know, confidence they would have had anyways, it wouldn't have mattered because, you know, the partner wouldn't have been able to understand the trick.
Something would have gone wrong.
Yes.
But because Kahlo said that,
he felt like he
was what went wrong.
And he has all these demons. You know, he feels responsible for holding Sarah back, you know, which is why he tries to let her go until Miss Magical Bunny of Love shows up.
Yeah.
And by the way, I love Fool's like, do I really have to do this?
Yes, you do.
You do. I just want to see the negotiation process between Sora and the Fool on that one. Like, so if I do this, you're going to give me 5 naked pictures?
I'd rather not think about that, thank you.
Oh, I'm a horrible, terrible person, but you already knew that.
Yes, that's completely beside the point.
That's the point.
But, you know, other nice thing about Kahlos as a character is that he was not afraid to let his performers tweak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hell, he let one of his junior performers develop an entire show.
Well, but that's the way he liked it, you know, and it gets revealed. He kind of preferred the old way where it wasn't the same show every night. And which is why he likes Sora so much, is, you know, she is sort of the embodiment of how he likes the show to be, which is different every night.
Which, again, you know, that show, it shows the sign of a good stage manager, or of a good manager, period. The fact that he can pull in the reins when he needs to, but he knows when to let some slack go.
Yeah.
It just still makes him a right bastard.
Well, let's move on to the plots of the minor characters.
Yes.
Let's start with Mia.
Ah, speaking of writing stories. Yes, again, you know, Mia turned out to be the brains of everything.
Mm-hmm. And it's fun to watch her growth as a character, you know, as sort of the writer and being comfortable with sort of becoming not just the writer, but sort of the director of the group. You know, with something that's continued in the second season, mind you.
Yeah. It's just the fact that she managed to show that she was more than just another performer.
Absolutely.
She became essentially the voice for the production.
Yeah.
By becoming its writer, director, you know, during the halfway point of the show. Which, again, that showed her on the one side of the spectrum.
And then you have Anna.
Anna on the other half.
Which we can talk about now.
Where,
I believe you had the best description when we talked about it once before a couple of years ago. You called her a clown who's best at being, what was the word you used?
Oh, that's a good question. God, how long ago was that? Oh, crud, even I can't remember the analogy I used, which is a pity because that was a good one.
Yeah, it was a clown who's better at being subdued or something like that.
A dramatic clown.
Yeah. But, you know, and then that's sort of the funny joke is like, she wants to be funny. Everybody knows her for being funny. And when she does a funny pose,
nobody notices. Goes,
like, what's wrong with you? And then she'll go into dramatic, like, oh, darn. And then all of a sudden, everybody's in love with her.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up, is the fact that she is perfectly designed to be a straight person. You know, the straight man to a comedy duo. But she wants to be the comedy part of the act.
Absolutely. You know, she's designed to be Costello, but she wants to be Abbott.
Yeah.
Which, God, every day I watch that baseball routine.
But, you know, again, you know, Mia being on the flexible, more intellectual side, Anna being the bronze of the outfit, so to speak.
Yeah.
And they're just there to show how Sora is in the middle.
Absolutely. Well, speaking about in the middle, let's move on to Sarah. She's in the middle of everything. And...
Yeah, Sarah just kind of sticks her nose everywhere.
Well, and she's another thing that provides a lot of comedy. A lot of times, it's so funny. You know, I went practicing for sumo wrestling. I really should take you guys. Although my favorite expression of hers is when they're changing light bulbs in that scene to where Carlos lets her go. And, like, and she recognizes, oh, it's paparazzi. Like, run, Sora! Like, Sora's like, what happened?
Run before they get you.
And I have to say about Sarah, wonderful job by Lucy Christian. You know, when you spend a lot of time watching anime, you know, you hear certain voice actors and you catch on to the way they use their voice. And so you can pretty much, a lot of times, guess who the voice actor is without even seeing the credits. Like, oh, this sounds like Lucy Christian. I'm willing to bet it's Lucy Christian, which was funny in the recent Hayao Ryoran Samurai Girls that came out from Section 23, where all the voice actors were using different names, but they were like voice actors we'd all heard before. It didn't make sense.
It was one of these, we're acting outside of our normal contracts.
I guess. But, you know, here, you know, you have Lucy Christian doing this English accent, and I've never heard this voice since, and it is such a spectacular voice.
I'm not going to say that it is a flawless British accent, because I'm not from the UK. But it was good enough to convince us it wasn't Lucy Christian at first.
But, you know, it's one of those things where I listen, I'm like, this can't be Lucy Christian. It never sounded like Lucy Christian. It sounded like a completely different person. It's such a wonderful job of voice work. I actually think this is probably the best voice work in the entire show.
Well, and on top of that, you know, she was playing the comedy relief.
Yeah.
She was truly the comedic relief, especially anytime Master Lin joined her.
Passive in or any of her other masters.
Yeah. But just the fact, you have this character who looks so prim, so proper, so elegant.
And especially when on stage, she's so elegant and, you know, beautiful and has a wonderful voice, and she's so goofy on the outside.
Yeah, and off stage, she's flailing around like a psychopath having an epileptic seizure.
And it's sort of the little bed's like, I want you to teach me that move right now. It's like, can all Japanese people do karate, right?
Yeah.
My favorite one is when Sora comes back from Japan in the second season and gives her the ninja outfit.
Although, that's something... that's an aside I want to bring up real quick.
Okay.
I find it hilarious that we are depicting an American cast, and when they were doing business dealings with other American cast... I'm talking in show, mind you.
Yeah.
They bowed instead of handshake. I don't know how many people caught that.
You know what? There are a couple things here and there. We talked about this before. The fact that they had the sun rising in the west.
Little colloquial misgivings there on that one, I think.
But I think they can be forgiven, to be honest.
Granted, you know, that's because we all know the source.
Yeah.
I just found that as a delicious little irony there.
Yeah. Or when they're all in the hospital and they're like praying, like they're praying to Buddha.
But okay. Moving on.
Well, let's move on to Mr. Policeman, who apparently, again, played by a gentleman. A man who will never be able to get a tan. Which, that makes it in itself a wonderful voice job right there. But yeah, Mr. Policeman, he's sort of the fatherly support since her parents are so far away for Sora.
He's the kindly father.
Yeah.
As juxtaposed to Kalos's hard-nosed father.
Yeah. Well, my favorite scene is when Sora's father comes in and he goes, "Oh, it's weird, this is my dad, Papa."
Yeah.
It's like, and they show like, "Oh," just like that is the correct response when a big black man goes to hug you. I would be afraid too. I'd also be afraid of a big Russian man or big white man or big. You know, man would hug me too.
I'm not entirely sure there's a whole lot more to say about the policeman, though.
And he brings his, he gets a lot more attention in the second season.
Yeah, he's still relatively one note in the first season.
Yeah. No, I do love in that first episode when he's driving her down and she's like practicing in the car. It's like, "Oh, just ignore me." It's like, "Yeah, I'll try."
Until that leg flies in front of his face. A little hard to miss that. Got to drive here.
Though, you know what? I think this also proves that it is in L.A. because those are definitely L.A. policemen. Well, let me put that. More Santa Monica because those are definitely Santa Monica policemen with their laid-back attitude.
I don't know. I'll have to rewatch it and check which city they mention. Yeah. And we will have to revisit that question.
Well, I'm telling you, because I just watched it about a couple hours ago. It's when they were in Vancouver, they said, "Freedom Lights from Los Angeles." So, but yeah, but they can't be L.A. police, because if this was L.A. police, the minute she did a handstand, they would be beating her into an inch of her life.
Ouch. Burn.
Yes, I went there.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Yeah, I was about to say, moving on.
Let's move on to, well, the LA police can't touch me, but anyways, moving on to Marion and Jonathan.
Ah, yes. Marion, the jaded little girl. Nobody's good enough to take my mommy's place. Until, hey, who's this bouncy girl?
Until Sora leaps on the trampoline and looks like her mother. And then, of course, Jonathan, the real star of the show.
Oh, yeah.
With,
you know, baby seal that sort of tripped over and then tried to hide him and took spare jobs to feed.
And ate fool.
Ate fool.
I come back and Jonathan's like, "Oh, this is terrible." It's like, "You have no idea what terrible is."
Which still leads the question, if Jonathan can see Fool, does that make him a potential?
Yes, it does.
Uh-oh.
Well, guess what? He does get his own stage show because he has his pen and Sora performs with him.
Yeah, again, and not to mention, you know, didn't hurt anything that he was voiced by Tiffany Grant.
A.K.A. the voice of Asuka, though. I actually don't remember much. I don't remember her much as Asuka from Evangelion. I remember her more as, Kuriko in Mabaraho.
Yeah.
And those big bouncy breasts. Yum.
Oh, you would.
Hey, I fully admit to being an Etsy fan. I'm damn proud of it.
But who am I to question?
Yes, who are you to question?
I am me.
But, you know, I love, they bring a lot of good comedy relief. And, again, it's just, they're fun characters to watch.
And they don't overuse them.
Which is important.
It was, oh, yeah, you know, they could have focused episodes upon episodes of Jonathan. Just to appease small children.
And girls. But they didn't.
But,
and I think that's something to talk about with the series. This is a series that is targeted towards girls. And yet, and they have their cute things here or there. But what makes this series so great and what makes this story is that it's a simple story. And it, the things that they may use to appease women really aren't used a lot.
Well, and the fact of the matter is they tend to maintain an ambiguousness in the style of the series. That way you don't have to feel that this is hey, this is a girly thing. Hey, this is, you know, guy thing.
Yeah, the series itself feels androgynous. It can be for both men and women, even though it is looked upon as a girl
series.
Even
though it was designed for one specific demographic.
Yeah.
But we like it too.
Well, again, and I think we can bring this up with final thoughts because, well, I did have a talking point of talking about the comedy of The Fool, but I think we talked about that.
Yeah, we covered that pretty good in the Fool section, I think. And every other section.
Yeah.
The Fool gets around. So...
That fool gets around. Duh. And he knows what he likes. He's got what you need. And one of the... I'm turning the fool into a female star of Footloose.
And they blame me for throwing things off track. It's not always my fault, folks.
So, final thoughts on this series.
You know, I tell you, this still remains one of my favorite series. Again, we've said it before, we'll say it again. This series may have been designed with little girls in mind, but they keep the story and the pacing of it in such a way that I think anybody can honestly watch this one. You just have to get past the fact that you're essentially watching gymnastics.
And circus, and it's a bit of a soap opera, because that is maybe the one thing, is that there are occasionally time here or there where it does feel a bit soap opery.
Yeah, you know, like, say, Sora's little crying outburst at the end. It's like, okay, enough of that. Please, please stop. Ow. Melodramatic. Melodramatic, stop.
But, you know, again, this is also one of my favorites, and I think, Fly podcasting is awesome, folks, especially when you hit your shelf unit that's right next to you. But no, this is a wonderful, and everybody should check it out. Again, same thing Lucid said, you know, supposedly made for girls, but everybody can enjoy it. And I think the reason is, again, because the story itself, the pacing is, to my mind, perfect. But again, the music and the art accentuate the story, which in itself, and I say this time and time again, and if I was to list all of my favorite animes and animations and stuff, they all have one thing in key, and that is the thing I always say, simplicity is key. The story of this series is very simple, but it's built upon with detail through character development, character building, and character interaction. And that's how a series should be done. That's how Thundercats is done. That's how the Disney movies like Beauty and the Beast and Sleeping Beauty are done. You know, it's character building. The story is simple, but the character building provides the detail and the meat of the series. And it's so wonderful to watch. Sora is such an uplifting hero to get into. You know, you can really rally behind her. And, you know, it's the reason why Kaleidostar is in my top three favorite animes of myself, and I also think it's in the top three greatest animes of the past decade. From 2000 to 2009, or would it be 2001 to 2010?
Either way.
But basically, you know, it's in the top three. In fact, I think it's the best anime of the decade, in my mind.
Yeah, I'm not so sure if I'd classify it as the best, but I would certainly put it high on the list.
Yeah. So this is, again, I think for any animation fan, definitely should have at least the first season. Because it's, and again, I'm going based off the first season. Second season, I'd put a little lower on the list, but still, you know, everybody should get the first season.
You know, get over the fact of the bright and colorful costumey cover and pick it up.
Yeah. So that's it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Lucid, thanks for coming on. Usually this is the place where we pimp other people's podcasts and stuff, but you don't have a podcast anymore.
And see, folks,
it's hijacked.
I don't always derail him just when I want to.
But, yeah. But thank you for coming on.
No problem. It's what they keep me around for.
Yeah, it's why we keep Lucid locked in that little box in the back.
It's why they haven't deleted me from their contact lists yet.
But thank you, Lucid. And, you know, again, if you have any comments or, you know, feelings on this series or comments about, you know, this episode that you want to leave, remember there are numerous ways you can leave it. You can leave comments on, yeah, the post itself, which you can, of course, you can find the website at www.an.132productions.com. Of course, when iTunes finally gets up, hello, future people, you can leave an iTunes comment. And, of course, you can also email by emailing to absolution132@yahoo.com. That's absolution132@yahoo.com. And, of course, remember to check out all our other 132 Productions podcasts, which, of course, include, you know, you have the Otaku Momentum right here on the Absolution Network. You can check out Tokyo SOS, which includes my Tokyo SOS podcast, which reviews every Godzilla movie ever made. We're about ready to go into the Henshi series, Lucid, which the 90s Godzilla series. I actually watched the other day Godzilla 1985.
I'll be hiding under my bed, thank you.
So I watched it and I was like, wow, this is really nice. Because it really felt 90s for something that was made in 1984. And then Godzilla appeared and they had the Flying Fortress and it got 80s real quick. But yeah, that's coming up. I actually hope to have a special guest for that one too. And then, of course, there's Comic Book Crazy, which... you know, we'll have you have the Comic Book Crazy podcast, which has a new episode as of this recording going up tonight. Hexcast, which reviews every issue of Terra, Witch of the Black Rose. And the new podcast, which, listen, I actually think you'll like this podcast, The Comic Book Pitch, which is an interactive podcast where you, the fans, send in your ideas for comic books. Mm-hmm. You know, do you have an idea for a Superman story that isn't Superman and Batman playing docking the space station? Lucid doesn't want to even know.
Is that what you kids are calling it these days?
Yeah. But, yeah. But if you have the idea... But if you have an idea for a comic book story, send it in there, and, you know, it'll be right on the air. And it's a podcast about comic book story ideas that we come up when we're, you know, fantasizing about what we do with our favorite superheroes.
This is what happens when we're bored. Imagine if we actually had something to do.
Yeah. So check out all those. Of course, check out all our friends, which you can find in the sidebar of the site, which include Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Back and From Crisis to Crisis, Brad Douglas' Spider-Man Crawl Space, Steven Slaker's Major Spoilers, Scott Gardner's 2-2 Freaks, and all our other friends, again, you can find them on that sidebar. Check them out. They do wonderful podcasts. And that's it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Next week, well, next week is the final week of March. And since the beginning of April is one of my favorite times of year, it's the start of baseball season. Because I play right field. It's important to know. You gotta know how to catch. You gotta know how to throw. That's why I play in right field.
I didn't do this, folks.
Where the dandelions grow.
Don't blame me this time.
Making it great.
You can blame me for SOS, but you can't blame me for this one.
What, you didn't like that Pizza Hut commercial?
Do you have any idea how many times I had to see that one?
Wait, is it really that horrible?
We owned the VHS version of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles
movie. So did I.
And it was on there.
I know.
And the fast forward button didn't work.
Well, it could have been worse. I could have said, take me out to the ball game. But anyways, why am I talking baseball? Well, that's because I'm actually doing another anime, which I feel is right up there with some of the best of the 2000 decade, and that is the first season of Big Windup. So that will be next week. And thank God it's on Hulu.
For a moment there, I was worried he was going to review Princess Nine.
Oh, now, come on! Princess. Yeah, we'll talk about that when we stop recording. And so that's it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Until next time, my Toonami generation, stay golden.
A cursed samurai. You have succeeded again in eluding my effort. But I am not worried. For one day you will fail.
By DJ Clark Nova. Don't sleep on it.